Come for the all right, mm-hmm. and stay for the game over, man.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
Listen to me.
You look like a...
What?
Radioactive tampon.
I wasn't supposed to...
You look like a banana with a yeast infection.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 133, and Aaron's showing off his basketball cards.
Mm-hmm.
Today's big recommend is Moon. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by the aforementioned Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Lunarinos.
Lunarinos, there we go. And we'd like to once again to welcome chat, who have come in here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Aaron, would you like to start us off with our small recommends?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I suppose I can do that. Let's talk Marvel Television for the first time in a while. Agatha All Along has decided to finally come out after several title changes and many delays as Marvel tries to figure out what they're doing with their TV shows. This is a recommend for me. Not even a soft one, really. It's I'm really enjoying this. Now, clearly, I'm only two episodes in. That's all that's out. I don't think the third one's out yet, unless I missed it last night or something. But these first two episodes I've really enjoyed. And I think the main thing I'm enjoying about the show is it's clear the team behind it is maintaining that creative spark of fun that they had in WandaVision. Now, if you didn't like WandaVision, then maybe this won't be for you either. But I really enjoyed how they would take old sitcom tropes and, you know, this one's kind of based on the Dick Van Dyke Show and this one's based on, you know, this, you know, the Brady Bunch or whatever. And they do a play on that in the first episode of this series. I don't think it'll continue, but I really enjoyed it. And then the second episode pulled me in because of the character work. Like, I like this group of witches that they're putting together, and they seem like a fun bunch to hang out with. And there's a musical element to it that I wasn't expecting. There's a really incredible music number in episode two that just blew me away. So... I'm just having a lot of fun. It kind of ticks a lot of my boxes, so I don't know if it's for everybody, but it's definitely for me.
How is this supposed to figure into Marvel's plans, by the way? Do you know?
I think the reason it's able to come out is because I don't know that it does an extreme amount. Certainly, there is some mention of Wanda in the first episode because, you know, this is where we're going from. Last we saw Agatha, Wanda was, you know, putting her back in the spell or putting her in her place or whatever. So there's a little bit of mention of that. But I don't think they're planning on any kind of huge... Now, I say that, and then in the finale, like, you know, Reed Richards' son shows up. You know, you just never know, like, how something's going to happen. But for right now, it just feels like its own kind of fun little thing. So
So it's kind of like Moon Knight was, where it didn't have any, like... real connection to the overall universe.
Correct.
Just like, well, although I mean, this has more of a connection than Moon Knight, maybe even because
it's just built into it.
I've seen the trailers. I'm not sure how interested I am in this. I do love Catherine Hahn quite a bit.
She's so good.
So I may have to watch it just because of her. But yeah, the actual show, I was like, maybe one day.
The other thing I will mention, because I think some people will you know, we'll find this interesting, is that this feels more adult than the other Marvel shows have been. Like, she tells a police chief to eat her ass at one point. Like, there's it just feels like they're a little more free to, she's naked for part of it. So, you know, I don't know. It just feels like they're being a little more free with this one than they have been with the other ones. So,
interesting. So it's got the full TVMA rating and everything?
No, they still managed to keep, like, when I say naked, I mean from, you know, from reverse.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Kind of thing. And strategically placed hair, you know.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Long and beautiful hair. All right, so I finally broke down and watched the Kevin Costner Horizon and American Saga Chapter 1 Which came out, I believe, 2 months ago in theaters, and then it just promptly bombed because Kevin Costner is cursed since Waterworld. I really do think that. I mean, not that the movies that have come out have been like, oh, these are just actually amazing, and it's just it's being brought down by the haters and everything. But he comes out a lot with these three-hour movies, and people are like, wow, what a self-indulgent asshole Kevin Costner is, and he probably is. But at the same time, when I first heard about this, I was like, I don't know if I want to watch this. This is a 3 hour Western. And I mean, not that I haven't been pulled into 3 hour Westerns before, but I found this movie actually quite good. The only thing about this is you can see that it's a chapter one. They are, you know, they are going to make four of these. I think they've already made the second one, and it's supposed to be, I think it's going to streaming somewhere. Maybe, I don't know. It's already made, and they just need to come out with a release date at some point. Three is already like in pre-production. I think four is already like pretty far along. So I don't like the fact that this is like, okay, we're telling you a chapter one, and this is going to be, I mean, you're going to feel like this could be a series when you're watching it, but I did like it overall. It's not great. It's not a super great movie. But I did think it was better than what I was being presented by critics a couple of months ago. So you have it's a sprawling Western epic. It's about a town that's being created basically in the middle of Apache country. And even though there are laws saying you can't do this kind of thing, expanding into this kind of territory, the U.S. military's kind of like looking the other way. They're basically saying, you know, these people are not supposed to do this, but guess what? We get rid of these people, there's going to be more coming along later on. This is, I believe, set pretty much in Montana. And the Apaches have a group of people. So one group wants to kill all the settlers that are coming in because they believe that their settlements are coming in and they're distracting all the wildlife that they need to survive. And they... There's one particular faction that's like, you know, we need to get these guys out of here because our way of life is not going to be, we're going to have to hunt in areas where there are other tribes out there, and we're going to have to, we'll be at war with them before we know it. So we got to get rid of these guys. And the story tells multiple stories going on. Kevin Costner comes in here and he has a relationship with a prostitute that's in one of the towns, and she has a baby. And there's like a whole thing with them sort of being this like wayward family. They're not really even, nobody is related to each other in that trio. But there's that kind of thing. There's a whole group of settlers led by Luke Wilson, who is Luke Wilson. So he's having a hard time like actually being an authority in anything. He's trying to police his settlers as they go through and everything. And then there's another story involving Jenna Malone, who has tried to kill these brothers' father, and the brothers want revenge. And so they are causing a lot of trouble. I think that's probably the strongest part of the movie, actually, the whole thing with the brothers and the revenge angle, and the acting is great in that thing. So you got a whole bunch of different stories being told at once. And like I said, I'm not saying this is great, but I am very much interested to watch part two. And maybe by the time all four of them come out, you'll just see the full picture as Kevin Costner is intending us, but you know, we'll also have to be sitting through 12 hours of movie probably by that time when it happens. But I did enjoy this, and I don't want to say that I'm not blowing smoke up your ass about this. It's, I actually really did like this, and I think it's worth a shot if you got 3 hours in your day.
I agree, and in fact, I think I actually may like it more than you, Chris. I really like. I think it is great. I think it's only. For me, issue is in execution. I would love for this to be four movies. That's fine. That's how Costner wanted to do it. You can tell he's so passionate. Like, he really feels like this story is something special. And but I really think if this had been like a four-part miniseries, on streaming or something, that the response would have been totally different to this, because I think this first part shows a ton of promise and is really like, even though it's 3 hours, I was engaged for the 3 hours. The movie does a really good job at introducing you to these characters, who they are, what their motivations are, why they're all kind of, I have a feeling Horizon, which is the town at the center of this, which I think is Arizona territory, is going to be where everybody kind of coalesces, and we're going to follow that town as it becomes an American town through the years. That's kind of what it feels like to me. You're right. The stuff in Montana with, you know, her trying to escape that family and, you know, trying to come south through Wyoming. And I think the Santa Fe Trail is part of it with the Luke Wilson group. And there's some interesting characters there too, and some interesting power dynamics that are going on there between, like, you know, rich tagalongs and, you know, the more earthy, settlers. I just think that it touches on so many different things. And that's before we even start about the Native American themes in this, and how much care has been taken to really honor the Native American placement in this movie. I think this is really good work. And I mean, it wasn't completely ruined for me, but I hated the ending where it was like, next time on Horizon.
Yeah. That was just gross.
It was terrible. Yeah. That made me angry. It almost made me angry enough not to like the movie, but not quite.
And especially considering you're a no frame
guy.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. The fact that it's like, here's what happens in chapter two. Well, and it doesn't matter how small the frame is. You're going to be like, okay, anticipating things that you
exactly.
didn't. Yeah.
So it took me about 10-15 seconds before I realized what was going on, and that's a lot of time. And then I got up my phone because I knew it was ending, and I just didn't pay attention to the rest of it. But just to because there's no warning, like, it just kind of goes into the next episode.
It looks like it's going into the next scene, and then suddenly it's like you know, it's like the old Lonesome Dove series, you know, where it was just like, next time, you know, or this season on or whatever. So
Other than that, I really, really liked Horizon, and I'm excited to see whatever he's able to make. It was supposed to premiere at the Venice Film Festival.
I think so.
So we'll see how it all goes, but yeah, I enjoyed it too.
Yep.
My second small recommend, I finally got around to seeing Ip Man.
This is good.
I was blown away by the action in this movie. I think it's just phenomenal stuff. I was a little bored in the in-between. I think the movie wants to be grander than I feel like it accomplishes. I know it's trying to be historically epic, as well as, the fight scenes. But the martial arts film stuff in this is worth the recommend enough, even if you don't connect to the overall story, which I didn't necessarily connect to that, so I wanted to throw it out there and as a recommend, because I had a really good time. There's some of the stuff he's doing in the group fights I've never seen that kind of stuff before, and I've watched a lot of martial arts stuff, so I was surprised at how surprised I was by what's going on in this. So
The excitement of Donnie Yen is I'm acting like I've seen so many Donnie Yen movies, but the excitement for me in this movie is just when he gets into those rapid fire punching episodes and everything. That's just
wild,
like, blow the mind, you know. And and so I haven't seen the sequels to these. There's a 2 and a 3, I believe. I don't know if there's any more after that, this first one was really good, and it fits the action bill quite well. I can second that recommend for you as well.
What was the there was a movie that just came out, I'm forgetting the title. It was long, it was like 3 hours long, some crazy action with like tigers, and it wasn't Bollywood, but it was like from the same area. what was that movie called? This reminded me of a movie of that, in that like it's trying to do crazy action, incredible things you've never seen before, but also be part of this historical epic story.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, and it's one of those that if you didn't ask me point blank what
right,
movie
yeah,
you were
yeah,
thinking
yeah.
of. But I think you're thinking of that Tony Jaa movie, right?
No, I don't think so.
I don't know.
Yeah, sorry. I shouldn't have brought it up. So apologies. It's RRR.
I thought at first I was like, no, surely you're not remembering RRR.
Yes.
So I didn't. I put that out of my mind. So anyway.
Yes, it was R. Yeah, I couldn't remember R.
Yes. All right. I'm going to recommend a non-movie for a change, and talk about the live show that Steve Martin and Martin Short put on. And I've seen this show twice now. The first time I saw it with Jonathan a couple of years ago. I saw it again this past week at the Grand Ole Opry. And they are still excellent performers on stage. Of course, they're still doing screen stuff with Only Murders, and I think they kind of do this every time there's an Only Murders season that's to promote, and it's a smart thing to do. They go out and they do this show, and it's really about Steve Martin and Martin Short showing friendship through ripping on each other the entire show.
Mm-hmm.
It is so fun to watch how they'll start with something that sounds very nice, but then it'll somehow be an underhanded compliment or a backhanded compliment. And so it's really fun. There's a point in there where Martin Short and Steve Martin sit down on a sofa or something, and Martin Short's like, now Steve and I said that we'll just keep on doing this, and we would always keep doing this as long as we would have fun, and if we weren't having fun, we'd just walk away. And Steve Martin immediately gets up and walks off stage and doesn't reappear for the longest time. So there's stuff like that. They go and they talk about their past and talk about stuff that they did together, and Martin Short, you know, how he got on the Three Amigos and how the friendship started then. And then there's sections where Martin Short has the stage to himself, and he does a sort of biographical type of thing. Steve Martin will then come on with his banjo and his band, and Steve Martin playing a banjo, man, you have to see this at least once. Like, especially if you were like, people our age who like grew up and saw Steve Martin as this funny and this wild and crazy guy, blah blah blah, all that, to see him up there just hammering a banjo with this band, who the band is awesome too, is just absolutely worth it. So if you get a chance, you see them coming to your town, definitely give them a shot. They are still fantastic at their age. They're in their 70s at this point. So very funny. The show that I saw was pretty much the same as the last one. They even joke about that. You know, they said last time we did this show, we went back into our room and we were trying to, let's make this better. And then we totally ignored that and you know, something, that type of thing. So, yeah, this is a well worth going to.
Is this pretty much the same as the Netflix special that they did? The Steve.
Not sure if I've seen the Netflix special.
It's called an evening you will forget for the rest of your life.
I am almost certain that show is probably very close to that Netflix thing, then, if you're talking about that, because I can't imagine them doing something completely different on that.
I'm very jealous. I would have loved to be in the room with those two as they riff on each other. That's fun times. That's bucket list kind of stuff, for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure. All right, we're gonna go on to our big recommend, which is Moon, and this is Aaron. So Aaron, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Sure thing. Moon is the 2009 directorial debut of one Duncan Zoe Haywood Jones. progeny of David and Angela Bowie, and someone who made this movie and then Source Code and then stopped making movies, and you can't convince me otherwise. We start off with some Lunar Industries ads position about how the world was saved by the power of the moon. All the energy we need is right above our heads, they say, before we cut to a scraggly-looking Sam Rockwell, playing a guy conveniently also named Sam, so I don't get too confused. Sam is hitting the treadmill at what we're told is a solo-occupied moon base on a 3-year contract. He soon gets a notification that one of the mining vehicles is full, so he heads out in his big wheel truck to grab the canister of helium-3. Live communications are apparently down, but Sam can send a recorded message back home, so he lets them know that the old sportsing games are really helping, but that he's kind of losing his mind and talking to himself. The good news is he only has 2 weeks left, but he tells Gertie during a haircut that it's not fair to the next guy to not have communications down this long. Gertie, who's a giant robot intelligence, voiced by one of the usual suspects, who shall remain unnamed and suspect, turns around a ceiling track system as he helps Sam out day to day while putting a wide variety of less than 5 emojis on his face screen to indicate his emotions. Later that day, Sam seemingly hallucinates a woman sitting in one of the chairs, resulting in him burning his hand with scalding hot water. He lies about it to Gertie and then has some sex dreams. The next day, Sam sees a weird glitch in his personal video, but tries to forget about it before he heads out for another canister of H3. But somehow, on a moon of 1, manages to be such a terrible driver that he wrecks his monster moon truck and injures himself pretty badly. Cut to Sam waking up in the infirmary, and Gertie is filling him in on the accident and his need to continue to rest after the crash. Despite this, Sam decides to get up and move around and thinks he hears Gertie talking to someone, but Gertie tells him he's just recording something for the boys back home. Sam continues his rehabilitation and notices one of the harvesters has stalled, so Gertie says he'll pass it along. So he goes back and has more dreams. Not sex this time, unless sex involves a ghastly spacesuit version of yourself reaching out to you from under your covers, which it might. I don't know. No judgment. The next day, there's a message from home base that they will send someone for the harvester, but he must remain inside the base. Sam doesn't like being treated like a child, so he decides to tear a hole in a gas hose so that Gertie will let him out to check the exterior for damage. But once free, he does what he really wanted to do, which is to go check on that stalled harvester. He sees the wrecked vehicle, and when he goes in to check it, he WTFs at the sight of another spacesuit occupied by, dun-dun-dun, someone who looks just like him. He brings him back and demands Gertie tell him who this twin is, but considering he's somehow still alive, they decide maybe the infirmary first before any answers. Accident Sam then wakes and asks if someone else is in the room, and Gertie's non-answer is, as always, unhelpful. New Sam then watches some more messages from home before old Sam wakes up and sees new Sam jumping rope. Gertie continues to do some sort of combination of gaslighting and conflict avoidance, while my two Sams finally have a one-on-one conversation during boxing practice, and they go full Dr. Seuss with a hearty game of Sam I Am. Later, during one of Sam's patented plant spraying sessions, old Sam thanks new Sam for saving his life and challenges him to a game of ping pong. They then play some sort of game where the ping pong ball apparently doesn't have to hit the table to be returned. The boys then discuss their wife Tess and their daughter, but now Sam seems to be much more in tune with dissecting, the logic of the two of them being there, and is very adamant that they must be clones before heading off to attempt to find a secret room that will prove his case. Eventually, he wants to look under the table where old Sam has been carving his entire city of building miniatures, even though he can only remember carving a couple of them. This leads to a violent scuffle where the model is turned over and old Sam gets his face very, very bloodied. Later that evening, after a heart-to-heart, Gertie finally comes clean to old Sam that he is indeed a clone and that all the test memories are implants. So old Sam is content to wait for the promised rescue to come, but new Sam is still dubious and swears there's more amiss considering he was supposed to let him die. The two agree that there might be some shenanigans going on, so they go for a ride beyond the edge of their base's usual area. They finally come upon some antenna-looking things, but old Sam starts feeling sick and needs to head back to the base to puke up his own teeth. It's clear at this point that old Sam is falling apart. After some clever using of a computer arm to crack into the database, old Sam is able to access some videos that continue to show that things aren't what they seem. And the cryopod chamber is actually just a cremation tube for old Sam's. He then finds and opens a compartment beyond this faux cryopod and finds new Sam's suspected secret room. Once Sam the Second returns, new Sam pulls a "I better come take a look at this" cliche, and they head down into the room. Once they're there, they are thrilled with the low, low prices because it's clear now that they live in a giant Sam's Club. Mm-hmm. Old Sam then heads out past the signal jammers and makes an actual live call home. A 15-year-old girl answers, and he finds out that Tess has died. She's his daughter, and she's calling, and she's being called by some guy with his voice. Back at the base, new Sam puts old Sam to bed and then finds the call log of old Sam's call home and decides something must be done. He goes to Gertie, and now assuming that Eliza, which was the code name for the rescue team, quote-unquote, is actually a code name for a kill squad that will kill him and old Sam, he convinces Gertie to wake up a new clone to save them. His plan? He wants them to take the new clone out to the wreck to stand in as the body of old Sam while old Sam hides out in the ship and stows away home. Old Sam, however, knows that he's pretty much already dead, so he suggests that new Sam take the journey instead and maybe hit up Mexico once he's back. They head back to the crash site and bond over their biased appearance-based hiring practices before old Sam passes out and new Sam has to carry him to the wrecked rover to finish his existence where he found him in the first place. Back at the base, Eliza is 1 hour away, and Gertie offers Sam the idea of rebooting him so that his memory banks can't be checked for evidence of what happened. New and improved Sam is all tucked into his H3 stowaway bay, but at the last second, stops the door from shutting so he can do one last thing to help out new Sam once he's gone by sending a vehicle straight into the signal jammer. Old Sam survives just long enough to spot the transport vehicle headed home, and some ending voiceover reveals that old new Sam is testifying against the company, and the opposition is blaming him because he's, of course, an illegal immigrant. Mm-hmm. Will the company prevail, or will this immigrant get the job done? The movie never lets us know, but leaves us thinking about clones' rights and the never-ending rationalization of the moral abdication caused by greed. And that is Moon. Chris, what did you think this time through?
I still love this movie 15 years later. I don't remember if I saw this in theaters. I think I did. I think I saw it in theaters at first. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it, and I enjoy it again on the second roll. I don't know if I have gleaned more into this viewing than I did last time. This movie's fairly simple in messaging and I don't think super deep, or at least when you compare it to all the other clone movies we've seen over the years. But I still think this is a really good and fantastic movie. I think mainly because Sam Rockwell is such perfect casting. If there is anybody who can do a one-man show in a movie, it's going to be Sam Rockwell. And I think he's just absolutely the most perfect casting for this. There's several others who could do this, I think, but like he is like I really, really appreciated the casting here. I love the grunginess of Gertie, the spilt coffee, the grime. Kevin Spacey sort of gives him a slightly more than Hal humanity, but the emojis are a lot of fun to look at too. I think the emojis are really fun because he's mostly smiling and trying to keep on a brave face, all that. But you can see those uncertain emojis and the occasional sad emoji that comes up there. I think really adds a lot of character to the AI in this. Chesney Hawks, "The One and Only," is a nice song touch for Sam to wake up to every day. I thought that was a lot of fun, especially since movies that focus on one are always going after that "one is the loneliest number" mm-hmm. song, it feels like. And yeah, this one is a sort of a different, they finally, hey, there's more songs involving one than just that "one is the loneliest number" one. I love the part. So the the new Sam wakes up and he gleans some information that makes him suspicious, and he goes out eventually and gets the old Sam, and they put him on the table, and I love Sam Rockwell in those sunglasses looking down at the old Sam, just looking at him with this disgust in his face, like, I can't believe there's another me on this. What in the world does this mean? And he's got this look on his only something Sam Rockwell can do, I think. The sunglasses just makes me laugh every single time I see it. He wants to sort of disguise himself, but he's not really trying to avoid it either. At the same time, I love that scene. There's a line at the end: "Gertie, we're people; we're not programmed." Easy message for the movie to make. I don't know if that theme is necessarily explored to the fullest, but when you consider the everyday routine that he goes through for 3 years, and where a higher power tells him that what he wants to hear to keep him going, certainly fulfills it in some way. But I don't know if that particular theme was explored a lot in this movie. It certainly is a nice little thing to towards the end that he says there. The movie is great about getting both Sams into the frame with no overuse of doubles. I think it's really done well here. In fact, I kind of forgot that Sam Rockwell had to act two different parts without himself in the other part of the frame several times. And of course they have a scene in here where he's playing ping pong, which is a really good one. Of course it's a CGI ping pong ball, but like still that's a complex thing that they had to do with that. And there's just several other things. I think there's a point where he gives him a piece of clothing. They had to do all sorts of stuff to try to get that to be right in the frame and everything. So for an independent movie to have the somehow look like way more expensive than it is, I thought it was a really good testament to the talent involved here. And then I think the choice that the new Sam makes near the end is an interesting one, because he wants to put the brand new clone in the harvester so that the team coming in can see a body. And it's clearly the older one who needs to go. He's the guy who needs to be back in that harvester. But it kind of goes to show that you will screw over the people you don't know, even if the choice is between you and you, basically. You know this clone, you don't know that clone, and I'm gonna screw that guy because I don't know I don't know him from Adam. And this is it's kind of an interesting choice, because it's clear what the real choice is, but in the end the movie sort of makes that decision for him. And I thought that was fun. But anyway, yes, loved this movie, and I don't have much more to say about that.
I think you're right. Sam Rockwell is probably the key to this working, so I think he is astonishingly good in this. And I think the subtle way he plays old Sam and new Sam really make it work. I'm never confused about who's who. Even if they're just, now part of this is that old Sam is deteriorating, so there's some physical evidence as well. So that's which also is very smart, way for the movie to distinguish. But he's also so much more of that brash arrogance when he's new Sam than old Sam does, and all of this plays into what I really started vibing with this time through the movie, which is, and again, I haven't seen this since it came out 15 years ago or whatever either, which is, I'm not sure the movie is more is as interested in the clones' rights stuff as it is in having us go, it's not about clones, it's about us, it's about the workforce, it's about the day-to-day jobs, the way that capitalism grinds its workers. Because there's so much here that feels purposefully analogous to just a regular 9-to-5 factory grind out job, in that, like, you know, over the course of 3 years, it chews you up and spits you out. You call home and you don't even recognize how much your children have grown because you don't even see them anymore. You know, like there are all these kind of moments where it's like a real indictment of the idea of using the workforce as tools instead of. So it's almost as if, yes, we're thinking about interesting things like, do clones have rights? Are clones actually people? But we're also going, wait, they're treating us as clones and we are actually people. You know, like the movie is kind of doing both of those things. And I think the second might be the even more important thematic stuff that the movie is doing. And that was kind of what I was vibing with this time through as I watched it. There's also things like, this is probably a stretch. Gertie is an interesting character in the movie because Gertie is a tool of the company, right? And yet at the end, Gertie makes a choice to help Sam out because Gertie actually truly does care about Sam, or at least is programmed to care about Sam, and some isn't, you know, somehow the coding allows Gertie to do that. By the way, I may switch gender Gertie because Gertie is a female name in my brain, but I know it's voiced by a male, so apologies if I do. But anyways, Gertie is interesting because, you know, you get the sense that those emojis that Gertie does are not really meaningful at the beginning. That they're almost like just something programmed as a way to endear the machine to the clone or the human or whatever. Like I got real like thoughts and prayers vibes when the tear emoji, you know, kind of started. You know what I mean? Like, you know, this, he's going through the worst thing ever and Gertie's just like, yeah, oh, tear, you know? And it's like, yeah, do you really mean that? But the transition to, by the end, go actually making a conscious decision, I think, in many ways is kind of about maybe, you know, management or middle management or even us as observers going from, oh, that's too bad, to, oh, I'm actually going to do something about it. I'm actually, you know, I actually have a role to play here in helping. So that was interesting to me, but might be a little bit of stretch. I don't know that that was intended, but it was definitely something I picked up on. I will also say the movie uses the AI, you know, computer bot character, it uses our pop culture understanding of that character's usual impact on a story like this against us. In other words, at least I am, expecting Gertie to turn heel, right? I'm expecting Gertie to be a part of the problem, be a part of the big bad, that everything is gaslighting. There's a lot of gaslighting that happens early on. And that at one point, just when we think Gertie is maybe making a good decision, Gertie's going to pull out a syringe and, you know, knock out Sam or something. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I can't do that, Dave. I can't do that, Sam.
Exactly.
Like, there's, you know, and so the fact that Gertie actually turns hero and not heel, I think is an interesting choice and one that works well for
It's definitely the movie. Playing on your expectations because he's so Hal in apparent, like in the way he talks and everything. That's the thing. You're sitting there hoping for that. You're not hoping, but you're thinking that shoe's going to turn just like Hal did. And so they play on that quite a bit. So, yeah.
Yeah. One other thing I really like about this movie is kind of the unspoken world building that happens in this. Like, I don't know that the movie, maybe you can correct me, maybe you saw something, but I don't know that the movie is ever explicit about what is happening to old Sam. And I think there are a couple options that we can believe. One is that when he was in that accident, he was exposed to radiation or something, and that's why he's deteriorating. But the other, and the one that I think it is that that's just, that 3 years is the lifespan of a clone. That, like, you know, they know that after about 3 years, clones start to break down, they start to fall apart, and that's why they have to, you know, do a new clone every 3 years. Because I can't figure out why they would need to do that.
I don't think they explicitly say it, but when he watches that video and they show, and it shows him going into the little pod and the steam goes over it and everything, I feel like that's the end of their life right there. Like when it's just like, it's that sort of like,
well, yeah, that's a crematorium thing. 'Cause he even sees the dust collecting at the bottom of the machine. Yeah.
And it looks like, if I'm reading this correctly, when they went down underneath, there's like a bunch that are red, like maybe that's mm-hmm. where they store the dead ones or whatever.
Mm.
So what are we? Wait, so what
I didn't
is the
notice
question
that.
Again?
I
yeah, it looked like there's some red light ones and there's some green light ones, all the way throughout the thing. And I got the sense that maybe the red lights, I don't know, maybe the red lights didn't mean anything, but it looked like there was a whole column where there was red light places where they're storing the dead Sams. I don't know. Maybe they don't even need to store them since it's a crematorium, but I don't know. That's the thing. But what, I guess maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
No, you're good. I just assumed the reds were the already used ones. That's how many had already been used, and those were empty, and then the green ones were the ones to be used.
Oh, okay.
So what I was saying was, I love that we're not explicitly told this is how it works, but that we're that we are able to deduce, okay, you know, he's deteriorated, he's spitting out teeth like this because clones only live 3 years, and that's why they have to cremate them at the end and bring in a new one. Otherwise, if they would, you know, do a longer contract or something like that. So there's this world building that happens. Like, even the fact that the daughter's 15 now, and you can kind of extrapolate and go, oh, okay, so they've been up here doing this for 15 years, 14 years, you know, somewhere around that, which means this is probably clone number 5, you know,
well,
somewhere
said,
around.
Like the chat was saying, they say 6 at the end. They think
there you
Sam
go.
6.
There you go.
So, but although is Sam 6, I can't remember if the Sam 6 is the old new one or the new one. If the new one is 6, then
that makes
you
sense.
you can't add 3 to him.
Correct.
Yet. You have
right.
to add 3 to only the ones that. So yeah,
you can't
so
even add.
Five,
you can't even add 3 to the to
new
the Sam,
brand new one
because he's brand
yeah,
new
so
too.
So you have 1 through 4 is the only ones right. you can do that. So yeah, there's 12 years total
yeah.
here and everything. So yeah, I think the red lights do mean the used ones, like you were saying.
Yeah,
and they have like just got like so many more. This is going to go on for millennia, apparently.
Yeah,
but.
I also like that it doesn't spell everything out. Like they don't have to have exposition where one of the Sams goes like, our lives are apparently only 3 years, and then they cremate us.
Yeah.
And then it's a very show don't tell movie, and I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing I really enjoyed about it. One thing I picked up that was probably not intentional but made me smile was the very first time they talk about helium-3, they abbreviate it on the sign as He-3. And this time I was like, oh, He-3, huh? Three
yeah.
he's?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that caught my eye. And then this is the first time, again, second time I watched it, that I noticed that the four machines that were doing the mining were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah, yep.
So I thought that was funny, too.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I loved it again. This will remain one of my favorites of all time. I love this movie.
So let me ask you this question, since we know that the original Sam is there with his daughter back on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you think that this works? Do you think that the company gives him a flat fee to copy him?
Yes.
And then they go off and just copy him ad nauseum from then on?
Yep.
So like they're definitely not paying him any profits for what his work is.
No.
I mean, that's not a hard thing to extrapolate because of the way this company is.
Right.
But that's what I was sitting there wondering. Like, you just what would be the fee? How much would you take for a company to clone you ad nauseum until the end of time? And what's the figure before you decide, all right, that's enough for me? Probably wouldn't be too much, right? Because you don't have to work for that money, but it still would have to be enough to be like, I kind of want to be set at the same time. What kind of, that was one thing that I was like, man, I'd love to know what the economics of that would be to sell your likeness.
Well, and how many recordings does your family have to do to be, you know, sent out? You know, for that repeating cycle, you know. So how many do you have to record, get in the bank so that they have enough to get through 3 years?
Yeah.
It's all interesting stuff for sure.
All right. Well, it looks like we're ready to do our super secret double feature.
Hi, podcast listeners. Danae here, and I want to tell you about Mint Mobile because they saved me money, and I appreciate that. Mint Mobile also made it easy to save money on my phone plan. So here's how it works. Here's how to get great wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of their three-month plan. You go to mintmobile.com/recotopia, and you're going to see all of their plans. And right now, all of the three-month plans are just $15 a month, and that includes the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, and you can bring your number along with all of your existing contacts. And that's it. That's how easy it is. Just you go and you look at the information, you're like, yeah, that doesn't seem so bad, does it? The hardest part is just deciding to break up with your current phone people. To get this new customer offer and your three-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That is mintmobile.com/recotopia, and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. Heads up, $45 upfront payment is required. That's equivalent to the $15 a month. And new customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
There were a lot in the chat that were really good. I mean, obviously, the first thing that came to mind was Oblivion, because the Oblivion has the sort of the same kind of story. Then I also thought of movies like Alien, where you have the company that will go to do things at any cost, human life not a big deal to them, that type of thing. 2001 obviously was in the equation. The Martian was in the equation. There's a lot that you can compare with The Martian, not only the being alone on a interstellar object, but also the Benedict Wong that barely shows up in this movie, but you know, Benedict Wong, there's a little connection between the two movies. Mm-hmm. But another thing that the thing that just kept going through my head all the way through this is that 3-year lifespan of these clones and the exploitation of, you know, what you consider non-human at this point. And even though I don't believe this movie explores this this very topic very well, I do think that Blade Runner is a good a super secret double feature for this movie for that very reason. We have, you could call Rutger Hauer's character the protagonist of this movie, because he is a slave and he's sentient, and he's like, look, you know, this is, you're just exploiting us. You're just, it's all, and you're only giving us I think it's a 4-year lifespan in Blade Runner. And so I thought this is the thing that I think is Blade Runner's biggest flaw, is that it's so much a Harrison Ford movie that it forgets that it's really should have been a Rutger Hauer movie all along. And so, like, you know, I think it gives you the idea that, yeah, these guys are getting exploited, but it doesn't really, really delve into it. But I think it is a good companion piece to Moon in that regard. So I thought that was that, even though, again, we did the faux recommend, or whatever you want to call it, for Blade Runner a month or so ago. And I still end up not liking it, even after I watched it 3 more times during that podcast. I think ultimately the themes that are involved in those two movies work well together. So there you go.
Nice. Yeah, that's a great choice. There are certainly lots of, movies that deal with clones and those kind of things, but this one deals with clones and also the same ideas that are going on in Moon 2. So yeah, I like this choice a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. On to what our homework will be for next week. And I believe this episode will be launching on the 30th. I believe that's how that works. It'll be on Monday. So this episode will be on the 30th. Our next live will be October 1st. And it's time to get into some Halloween-type horror and whatever. Horror movies in general, I do believe. And the one that I came up with here for next week is Frailty from 2001. This is one that definitely deserves another look. I don't think I liked this movie the first time I watched it. I saw it in theaters. And then I watched it again probably two or three years ago. And I was like, I was wrong about Frailty. Frailty's got it going on. I love this movie. Matthew McConaughey is in this along with Bill Paxton. And again, look, Matthew McConaughey is kind of playing like, it's almost like Lone Star where he's not playing the guy in the past. He's playing one of the young kids in the future, essentially. And he's telling the story about Bill Paxton, his dad and he and his brothers. And it's about a father who believes in demons and he's teaching his kids how to hunt demons. And this is one of those just really fun horror movies. Have you ever seen this?
I saw this movie, for the first time within the last year. And I loved it. And there are certainly things we will talk about, caveats to that statement when we go over it. But I think the movie does make some choices that kind of saved the movie for me. I think the end of my review was. Come for the all right, and stay for the game over, man. that's my short non-spoiler review.
Okay, all right. Well, it'll be interesting to see how you feel about it on the second run through. Then, I haven't seen this probably in a few years at this point, so maybe I will have a change of heart. But I figure this is a good start to October. I'm looking to get into some like bangers probably for October as well. So this one will be a good start to all that. All right, I believe we have some time for some questions.
Before we get into questions, I wanted to bring up a comment that Nick made in the comments because I hadn't thought of this, and I wanted to run this by you about the movie about Moon. Nick says, I assume the first time was Sam actually, and then it was clones after, because she said that him going away was good for the relationship. I think that might be right, Chris. I think maybe Sam actually went for the first 3-year contract to help their, like, you know, that they were having trouble and this would be good for them. She got sick or something like that, and then he had to go back, and that's when they started using clones. It also kind of explains why people didn't really, like, it wasn't a big widely known that they were using clones, like that kind of thing. Like, maybe they just kind of snuck it in after he came back.
Okay, so you think so that theory says, or that hypothesis says, that the real Sam has gone up there.
The real Sam. Yes.
He's there for a year or so. Wife says, basically says I'm sick. He gets to leave. They start using the clones immediately. And then he spends time with his wife as she dies, essentially. And so I don't know. It certainly works for me. I mean, there's no reason why that can't be.
Maybe there is a reason. They would have had to have built that underground bunker for all those clones. Like, they didn't, like, build that. Like, they had to know clones were going to be involved when they built this station.
But maybe your idea is that you make him work for 3 years, and then after that, it's all clones.
Right, yeah,
maybe,
yeah.
Maybe
that's the plan.
Like, it's a real 3-year thing that he's going up there for.
Right.
There's also the thing they're saying earlier, I don't know if that was a lie or what, but they said they were using memories that they tapped into the original Sam to do those videos. And I don't know if that was just some blowing some smoke up his ass or what. I don't know if that's the case. But that could have been a thing too, where it was just, you know, I don't know that. I mean, but I think both of those hypotheses are valid, that he never went up there. Or that he went up there one time and then had to go back. That either way, it works. But you're right. They totally intended this to be a clone operation because they have a giant facility of clones underneath. So
Yeah. I like that, again, that point by Nick that he had to have the knowledge of what he was. They don't have to train those new clones to do this job. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, he definitely at least went through the training. So, yeah, that kind of makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah.
Nicely played.
Yeah. All right.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What are some of the best movie scenes where you could easily say nothing actually happens during the scene?
Immediately, I thought of the Everything Everywhere All at Once rock scene. You could say nothing happens during that scene, that mm-hmm. it's, you know, just a couple rocks with some text on screen. It is possibly the most happening in the entire movie during that scene. Like, mm-hmm. it is the realization of the movie's, you know, thesis and understanding of what's going on. That scene is so powerful, so meaningful, and it's just a couple of rocks on a ledge. So that was the first thing that came to mind with this question for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever seen the movie Audition?
Is it a fairly recent one? Is it about like violent? Like
came out in like 2001, I believe.
It's
Takashi Miike's movie.
I don't think so.
But yeah, it's a horror movie, but there's a scene in Audition where a man is sitting there debating on whether to call this apartment, and he finally calls the apartment, and there is just this solitary woman sitting in the apartment, crouched down, her hair just all the way down, and she's in this one position the entire time. And when the phone rings, you see this devilish, evil smile come up on her face, and that's it. There's nothing really happens in that scene, but everything mm-hmm. is happening in that scene. It's kind of like the thing that you're describing because that rock scene is so emotionally resonant in that movie. So,
mm-hmm.
Looking over at the chat, let's see more talk about Moon. You know what? Now that the chat has gotten into talking about Moon, maybe this movie is more complex than I thought it was. I mean, there's so many like little different ways to look at certain things on that movie now mm-hmm. that I'm like, maybe it is a little bit deeper than mm-hmm. Nick says every scene in Batman v Superman, nothing actually happens in any of the scenes where two people are in the same room talking at each other, just empty platitudes.
But are those the best scenes? I would call those the best scenes.
They might be the best scenes in Batman v Superman. If you want to give a superlative to that movie.
Sure.
Nolan says the end of The Descendants where the family is just eating ice cream and watching a nature documentary. Yes, that's a great one.
That's a great one.
Jets Met says Dark Knight when Joker is telling a story about his dad being a drinker. Yeah, you know, that's absolutely correct. I mean, he's just telling some BS story there, you know, like none of the, mm-hmm. we don't know what any of those, if any of those are true. Let's see. Castroff says the movie Lock, the entire movie, just the whole entire thing. Let's see. Josh says the entire movie, The Green Knight. Let's see. And then Castro says, ooh, the shawarma scene in The Avengers. Yeah, there's definitely nothing going on there. Man, I tell you what, that was the cue for everybody. Like, they did not need to wait around till the end of the event of any mm-hmm. Marvel movie. Like, there hardly any like important scenes at the end of these things, and you sit through 13 minutes of credits to watch it. So, and then finally, Nolan says Moneyball when Billy Bean is turning the radio on and off. Great scene.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to do it for this week. Next week will be Frailty from 2001. Looking forward to talking about that one again. But that's going to do it for today. We'll see you next time. See ya.
See you guys.
Bye.
Be a
part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
To my left, I have stacks of my old basketball cards from when I was growing up.
Ooh.
And I've bought like these little top loaders,
yeah,
and stuff like that, because I'm going to take some in. I am under no delusions that any of these are in good enough quality to like rate high, like PSA graded, mm-hmm, or whatever.
Right.
But just in case, because I've got, you know, a dozen or so old Jordans, you know, mm-hmm, and those can go for a lot if they're rated decently. In fact, even like a PSA 9 can go for a couple hundred bucks.
Yep.
I'm not counting on the guy at the sports shop telling me, oh yeah, you should get these graded. I'm counting on him going, just try to sell them for what you can. But we'll see.
Yeah, I have the same sort of deal. I've got, a million baseball cards, but they were made during an era where they over manufactured them.
Right.
And then I have a few basketball and a few football cards, and some good ones. Like the other day, it was funny. I was showing Jeremy and Jonathan a bunch of cards that I had, and took pictures and wasn't really looking at what was in the pictures. It was like, here's some stuff that I still have in these binders and everything. And Jeremy's like, you have a Barry Sanders rookie card? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I do.
That's but amazing.
even the Barry Sanders rookie card is not like ridiculously like pricey or anything like that.
Well, for sentimental value, let's talk turkey. How much do you want for it? Like, I you know, that's the Lions right there, baby.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, thankfully my cards have all been in binders the whole time. Like they haven't been loose anywhere or anything like that. So they're not damaged at all. Like to the naked eye, they look mint condition. But it's just, mm-hmm, once you get them under that like tool that they use to look at the corners and the edges and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and actually with the macro lens on my camera, on my phone camera, I can even tell, like, you know, you zoom in and you can kind of see, oh, there's some,
yeah,
you know, fading there on the corners.
Mm-hmm. There was a thing, it's still going on, I think, but I know that there was a big expose on this by Carl Jobst on YouTube. He's talking about how old video games were going for exorbitant prices,
yeah,
that they probably shouldn't. And he found out that the people grading these games were also people who were responsible for telling people that, oh, this sold for this amount of money. And there was a lot of conflict of interest on stuff like that, stuff that they were doing and probably making money off of while they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were giving stuff like a certain grade and this costs this amount and whatever. And then people, of course, would sell a Super Mario, an original Super Mario kart for like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they just keep on perpetuating it by writing articles afterwards saying this got sold for $125,000. Amazing, right? We are completely independent of all of this. We don't know how this is happening.
Alan Trammell was my favorite baseball player growing up for the Tigers. Incredible, yep, shortstop, and finally made it into the Hall of Fame a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have all of his cards. I mean, all of his, mm-hmm, main, you know, cards. They've started doing so many more cards of older players now that I don't have like the new ones of him that, you know, they've made, or many of them. But anyways, I have his rookie card. Well, his rookie card is with other shortstops, including Paul Molitor, who's another Hall of Fame player. And it's, mm-hmm, so they're, you know, it's a double Hall of Fame rookie card.
Yeah.
If it was PSA 10, it would sell for $42,000. The last one that sold PSA 10 went for $42,000.
A Molitor Trammell going for $42,000?
Because it's so old and there are so few of them in that condition. You know what I mean? That would be that yeah. good.
If that's insane.
If it's a PSA 9, it's like $1,200. That's how huge that drop is from 10 to 9 with a card like this. Mine would probably be a PSA 6 or something. You know, like it's not in perfect shape. And the centering is really off too, which that's the thing. That's one of the most annoying things when you start looking at how things are graded is the centering, because literally not in your control. Like, you know, that's just a manufacturing thing. So mine's probably worth $100 or so, you know, but it's so funny that like such value has been placed on these grades, you know, on this grading system. So yeah, I think the PSA 10 population of that card is like under 40. So that's kind of one of the reasons why it goes for that much, but yeah.
Yeah. I've got all my best ones in the binders and stuff, but there's probably a few floating around out there that are like, oh, this probably should have been in a binder or whatever. But
I had one. I'm sorry. Did you have a story you were going into? I have one that I found out as I'm going through this that I had no clue was valuable. It's not. I even forget the player's name. Right. But it's some random player from the Knicks or something in one of the sets that I have a complete set of. But Michael Jordan is in the card and he's like in front of the player, like the player's like going up over him and he's like trying to box him out kind of thing. And it was the only game in Jordan's history that he wore the number 12.
And
so Michael Jordan with the number 12 is on this card. And in fact, the rumor is they changed that card in the next like the next release of those cards. You know how like there are like series, anyways. There are even fewer of them. And the rumor is that Jordan was like, I don't want a card out there with the number 12 on, you know, on my jersey or whatever. And so he made him change it. So I had both cards, the old one and the new one. And I was like, you know what I should do in this binder? I should put them together. I'll put the old one in front and then I'll put the, you know, the new one in the back.
Oh, yeah.
And in doing that, I bent one of the corners of the one that's actually valuable. So just that decisions you make, you know, 40 years ago or whatever. Yeah.
That was the thing. I was really huge into baseball cards and I had subscriptions to two baseball card magazines, Beckett and then the one just called Baseball Cards. And they were very like good about telling you, hey, if you put it in this, be sure not to like put two in one that. Or don't use these style of sheets that are made with this chemical or, you know, this type of thing.
Right.
And so,
yeah.
So it was pretty good about that because, you look at the cards I have here. I put those cards in those binders over 30 years ago. They still look like what they did back then. There's also a card out there. I can't remember who was on this card either, but it has the Menendez brothers.
Yeah, I have a couple of those too. It's Mark Jackson.
Yeah. This was apparently after they got the inheritance, I think, and they were just going and spending all this money.
Yep.
And they were front row at Lakers games and everything. God, what a...
Yeah.
Insane.
That's one of the ones I'm going to get an opinion on because it is one of the most valuable from that set because that's an overproduced set. I think that's NBA Hoops. I think that's 1990 NBA Hoops, which was, you know, there are a ton of those cards out there. But there are fewer of that one because nobody really... necessarily saved it like they would a Jordan or, you know, whatever. And then only recently people have been like, that's the Menendez brothers. And so now people want it. So.
So like there was a debate when I was, you know, doing the pod prep as to whether I'd make the substance I recommend. And so like I thought about it and I talked with somebody who'd seen it and he brought up one of the flaws of this movie that I had been mulling over, and I realized it's maybe It's like a near fatal flaw.
Mm, those are the worst. When you've got a movie you kind of like, and then it's like, oh, but this ruins the whole thing.
Yeah. I can't really get into what the flaw is, but there's a very specific thing that they're telling Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley during this whole thing that they don't explore it nearly enough. And if they had, it would have been a much richer experience. Now I see what they're doing. The director really wants to get towards this ending, which is, I won't get too much into, but like wants to get to the ending of this movie. And that ending is very successful. You cannot leave the theater without thinking about it. But had she employed, let me look real quick.
Mm-hmm.
I think the director's name is Coralie Fargier. She's a French director. I think if she had explored that one thing that they keep repeating throughout the movie, then you would have had something. As is, there's kind of a disconnect towards the end of it, even though the end is wild. But yeah, it's one of those things where I was like, I could possibly, this was the discussion we were having last week. I could recommend this, but this might be a Maxine where you're like, you know, you're by the time you're ready to say how good this movie is, you're like, wait a minute. There are some things about this that aren't quite. In fact, the one thing about Maxine that makes it not perfect is what is now making me hold back from it. And now that you have a lot of distance from it, it's like, oh yeah, they totally dropped the ball there.
Mm.
And so The Substance, I don't think is as much of a ball dropper as Maxine is. But there's something they could have explored there. Especially there is quite a bit of filler in this movie. So I don't know. It's an interesting one. I know for a fact, Aaron, you would not like this movie.
I will see it. I'll wait till it's out on like VOD or something. But I'm sure I'll see it just because I see everything. But
yeah.
But yeah.
I don't think you'll like it. But yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things to like in the movie.
I'm curious because, and again, I haven't seen any trailers. All I know is kind of what's in the general pop culture consciousness, which is Demi Moore, right? Demi Moore's in it, and Margaret Qualley. And my understanding is that it's about plastic surgery, maybe something like that, like the ideas of appearance and, you know, what it is to upkeep appearance and to be a woman and have to upkeep appearance. Like, that's an interesting topic, like body positivity, all that stuff is the really interesting to me. So
you got it dead on as far as the theme is concerned.
Okay. So I'm really curious about it because I love those kind of thought-provoking conversations. The other thing I'm picking up on is it's really graphic, which, you know, doesn't surprise me either. So,
yeah, it's super graphic. But yeah, there's when you watch this movie, you're going to be reminded of something constantly by the movie. The movie itself is telling you this is a thing. And then by the end of it, you're like, but wait, was that really a thing? I don't know if it was a thing, actually. By the end of it.
So what you're saying is the movie could have used a little film Botox, just tightened it up a little bit.
Right, exactly. Just, you know, like, don't necessarily, what was it? What's the thing in Knocked Up that they keep telling Katherine Heigl? They're just telling her to tighten.
Yeah.
They're not telling her to lose weight. They're telling them to tighten.
That's right. Yes.
American Giant makes great clothing. T-shirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.